Listen, I want to thank everybody for doing this today. I'm going to give you just kind of a snapshot of what it's like to do Senate work from your home office and what I am very focused on before we go back to Washington, hopefully on April 20. And then I'll talk about what I'm hearing from Virginians and the priorities that we ought to focus on in our future legislation around COVID-19. So we worked very hard to pass three big bills by big bipartisan margins during the month of March. The first bill obviously dealt with supplemental appropriations to the healthcare system. Second bill dealt with paid sick leave and unemployment insurance. The third bill, by far the largest, $2.2 trillion, bigger than the stimulus bill in the aftermath of the 2008-2009 fiscal crisis. It was a real heavy lift. We think, and we learned some things in the bill. There was an original Republican proposal on the table on a Sunday that was not a bipartisan proposal, and they were sort of take it or leave it. And even though colleagues of ours were getting diagnosed and staff members were getting diagnosed and at least one spouse was being diagnosed, the Democratic senators would not just vote on the Republican offer to get out of town. We stayed and tried to get it right for the American public. And so the bill that we passed on March, I think it was 25th or 26th, was dramatically better because we hung tough and negotiated with the Republicans and with the White House for a few days before we made it better. It ended up being better for businesses, better for small businesses, better for individuals, better for the healthcare network, and better for state and local government. There is going to be an effort, I guess, today. The Leader McConnell indicated he wanted to put a proposal on the table for a voice vote. He put the proposal down without even discussing it with Senator Schumer. It's a small business proposal without even having any discussions about it with Ben Cardin, who is the head of the Small Business Committee on the Democratic side, the ranking member. And like the show vote on the Sunday, it's a stunt. And we need to make sure we get this right. And so that's what we're doing. We're spending time talking to Virginians about the magnitude of this challenge so that we can act as we have in the first three bills and do a next bill that will continue to try to get this right. During the time that I've been in Richmond, basically every day it's the same thing. I start sometime, 8:30 or 9 on telephone calls, conference calls, or Zoom conferences, and I go all the way through dinner, and I talk to Chambers of Commerce, the Nurses Association, the Medical Society, the doctors, mayors and chairs of county boards of supervisors, state legislators. We have a weekly call with the governor and his cabinet, the entire federal delegation, Virginia School Board Association, Virginia Municipal League, Virginia Association of Counties. We are doing everything we can to reach out to stakeholders. I'm doing a session with the Virginia Hispanic Chamber of Commerce this afternoon. I did a massive statewide town hall that was a bilingual town hall last week. And in all of these interactions, whether it's with a person or one company or an organization or university presidents, I basically do four things. One, ask people to tell me what they're experiencing. Two, explain what were in the three pieces of legislation, especially the big economic backstop package. Three, I ask them to give us reports of any implementation issues. What are things that aren't being implemented well that we can smooth out? And we've already had some significant ability to work with the Trump administration to smooth out some implementation issues. We smoothed out an implementation issue so that kids could get school lunches without having to physically go to their schools that were closed. We intervened with Secretary of Agriculture Sonny Perdue and got that straightened out. We got it straightened out so that folks on Social Security or Social Security disability don't have to file a tax return before getting their $1,200 or $2,500 check. They can get it in a timely fashion. So many of the issues that we're talking about are how can we fix implementation issues, and I'll give credit to many of the folks in the Trump administration. They've been very willing to work with us on a number of fixes. But the last topic we talk about in all these conversations is what should be included in additional legislation. Five pillars of the last bill were aid to individuals, aid to small businesses, aid to larger businesses and industry sectors, aid to states and localities, and then aid to hospitals and the healthcare network. And so it's likely that future bills are going to be kind of similarly looking at those five pillars. I will say one thing that I think it's incredibly important that we do in any piece of legislation, whenever we do it, the next piece of legislation needs to make absolutely rock solid clear that when Congress passed the third bill and we put meaningful accountability and transparency provisions in it so that funds could not be given to businesses with no public transparency over who got the money, so that there would be an inspector general who could monitor the program, so that we would stipulate that none of the funds would go to businesses connected to the president, vice president, cabinet, or senators or house members. We all agreed on those provisions, but when the president signed the bill of the massive, you know, multi-thousand pages, $2.2 trillion, he only publicly declared fault with one piece of the bill. He didn't like the accountability provisions that we put in place concerning monies that were going to be given to companies. I have grave concerns that the reason he doesn't like them is that he is thinking about benefiting companies that he's connected to or using improper criteria for to decide which companies might get a benefit and which don't. Subsequent actions earlier this week, the president sacked the inspector general who was tasked with leading the Pandemic Accountability Commission. I am deeply troubled that at a time of national emergency, what the president seems focused on is not getting these dollars out the door, but on instead eliminating the transparency and accountability provision. So I, at a minimum, and I know there are other issues that we would like to take up in the next piece of legislation, but I think at a minimum, we have to get the Republicans, and that this should not be hard. They already agreed with it in the bill we passed. We have to get the White House, the President, Secretary of Treasury, and others to agree that there will be complete transparency and appropriate conditions on how these funds will be distributed. The American taxpayers deserve that, and I think Congress made its intent very clear, and I'm deeply disturbed that the president is making an effort to end run those. Nevertheless, I think we're going to be able to find a path to a next piece of legislation, just as we did in the earlier three bills, but I can guarantee it's not going to be Republicans put a proposal on the table and then sort of dare us to vote for it or vote against it in a partisan way. This pandemic should call us to rise above partisanship and figure out ways to do legislation that can gain a big bipartisan consensus, as the first three bills did. And we only get there if we talk to each other, listen to each other, negotiate House to House, party to party, Congress to the White House, and we follow the requirements of what we put in place. So with that, I'm really glad to open it up and talk about any aspect of this.
Yes, Senator, this is Caleb Perney at WCYB-TV in Bristol. I wanted to ask you two things. One, what are some more needs that you see that are going to be needed to fulfill to help folks in the next bill? And second, on the paycheck protection loans, that's going to be a week tomorrow since the applications have been available. We've heard some folks, other representatives, senators, talking about the need to increase funding for that. How do you see that program's going on that end?
Let me take it in that order, and I think I heard the first question correctly. Look, this economic challenge is driven by the public health emergency. There's no amount of economic aid that's going to be enough to get the economy going again if we don't handle the public health side of this right. And so we continue to have significant need to try to deal with the health side of it. We don't have adequate testing compared to other nations. We need to ramp up testing. We don't have adequate equipment and material and supplies compared to other nations. I've been on the phone extensively with Virginia hospitals, and they are reporting a really troubling phenomenon, which is they order supplies, which is hard enough to do, and they have to pay more for them than they used to. But when the shipment comes to their hospital, it's 90% of what they ordered, or 80%, or 1%, because FEMA has commandeered some portion of their order without telling them. Now, obviously, there are needs in some parts of the country that would make us understand why we would want to triage to those parts of the country, but that FEMA is commandeering orders that these hospitals make without communicating with them, just is shocking. At a minimum, you would want to communicate and then guarantee that a hospital that's losing some of its order to another part of the country would be guaranteed that those resources would be there for them if they experienced a surge. Hospitals do not have the confidence in that. So we need to, in the first instance, really make sure that we're getting the public health piece of this right, because no amount of economic aid is going to be sufficient if we don't do that with respect to the Paycheck Protection Program. So this is the heart of the small business pillar of the package, the Pillar 2, $350 billion of potential loans. It went live last Friday. There were a lot of, on opening day concerns that people were having a hard time getting the applications done with the SBA lenders they were working with. And I've certainly heard those concerns, some of which you understand. A program of that size, trying to stand it up in 6 days after the passage of the bill, is very difficult. So on the opening day, there was going to be some challenges. But I have also heard from some businesses who did apply last Friday, and by Monday they were already given an approval. You've been approved for a loan, and you should expect the funds soon. So I'm trying to monitor as I talk to chambers of commerce, for example, the Hispanic Chamber statewide that I'll talk to this afternoon. I'm interested in their experience. I'm trying to monitor the experiences of small businesses. But it looks like after a crush of applications at the beginning, the program is getting more kind of into a routine in terms of accepting applications and trying to be prompt and responding to them. I certainly understand when Secretary Mnuchin said the size of the business challenge is so great that we'll need more funds for this program. I certainly get it. I just want to make sure that we're going to be putting more funds out there for businesses, that there's transparency and accountability in the way we're using them. I think we owe that to our citizens.
Hey, Senator, it's Mike down at Channel 13 in Norfolk, WDEC. Hey, quick Navy question. You might see that they've been in the news a little bit in the last 7 or 8 days. Wondering how confident you are now in leadership going forward that Admiral McPherson has now been picked to be the acting secretary. Do you have a good feel about him? And just a short time ago, General Hyten had a press conference at the Pentagon, and he said it would be a mistake for us to think that what's happened on the TR is going to just be confined to the TR. We already have COVID small outbreak on Nimitz, and he says we need to be prepared for it to happen on other ships. How worried are you about that?
Mike, I think it's a very legit worry. We have COVID not only on Nimitz, but also on the Reagan and the Vinson. And look, I get a daily briefing from the DOD about the number of COVID cases, and they break it down by service. They don't break it down by where people are. But the Navy's been the hardest hit so far, and I think it's easy to understand why. I think folks in the Navy serve in closer quarters, more commonly than maybe folks in the other branches. And so the Navy's been hit the hardest. The situation in the TR was really, really regrettable this week, and Secretary Mobley did the right thing by resigning after he flew there to berate Captain Crozier. Captain Crozier was just trying to keep his people safe, and obviously under an incredible strain. So we have a weekly SASC conference call with the DOD to go over what is the latest, both in terms of reports, but what are they doing? I'm certainly encouraging the DOD around things like, you know, boot camps and training exercises. Should you consider delaying those? If you decide that you can't delay them, should you pre-quarantine folks who are going to go into those exercises or go on deployments for a period of 14 days or more just to make sure that nobody in that cohort is ill? If you do that, it may affect other personnel issues. You may need to reach out to members of the armed services who are nearing the end of a contract period to see if they might extend for 6 months or something. So we're trying to focus on both the health side of it, and the COVID-3 bill had significant resources for both the DOD and VA to deal with the health side of the operation, but it may also affect training, manpower, personnel requirements. And the good news about that is we're not only working on the next piece of COVID legislation, but this is the time of year where we work on the National Defense Authorizing Act. You know, normally try to pass it out of committee by Memorial Day or June at the latest. I have a feeling that the NDAA this year will be heavily focused on COVID-19 and health-related issues.
Senator, this is Brendan Ponce from WTKR in Norfolk. Again, this morning, the unemployment report came out, and numbers are up across the country and in Virginia. We've been hearing, you know, some people are having trouble with the system in terms of filing claims. Have you been hearing that from constituents? And, you know, do you think the numbers are going to continue to go up?
On the latter question, yes, the numbers will continue to go up. And on the former question, there are huge challenges. I mean, just to give you a magnitude of the challenge. So it's not only that the businesses are closing and so many people are losing their jobs. That's part of the reason why it's difficult to get a claim filed, or it can take a lot of effort to get one filed. Congress also dramatically expanded the universe of people who are eligible for this emergency uninsurance benefit. So there's this emergency benefit that's available for 4 months. Only about 30% of the American workforce traditionally is within the unemployment insurance network. But what we did is we recognized that the American workforce today includes a lot of self-employed or independent contractors or gig workers or small business owners who normally wouldn't be part of the unemployment insurance universe. But we have not only increased the benefit, we have also extended the universe to include those folks. So a VEC office that was used to a normal caseload suddenly experiences a dramatically higher caseload, first because of the economic slowdown, but second because a whole lot more people are now entitled to benefits than were the case before we passed that bill 2 weeks ago. So I think at the front end, yes, it's a challenge. The VEC in Virginia and every employment commission in every state is hiring and trying to staff up. But I'm trying to monitor this, you know, every day. In fact, we have our federal delegation as a weekly call with the governor on Thursday afternoon. And that's one of the questions I'm going to ask today. What are we seeing about the staffing up of the VEC to handle this avalanche of claims? And that's what we need to do. And like the Paycheck Protection Program, the first day out of the gate, it's a challenge. But I do think we're now directing the resources to it, including the COVID-3 bill gave resources to states to do this extra hiring.
Senator, it's Santiago with WFXR in Lynchburg. Thank you for joining us today.
Mm-hmm.
My question is about the COVID-4 bill. And if there are any specific provisions you're trying to get in there as it pertains to individuals, not small businesses.
Yes. So the answer is yes. So there's a series of things. First, anything we do for the healthcare network is for individuals. So, you can look at this bill as the pillars, and the fifth pillar is this healthcare pillar, but it's for individuals. So you're trying to make sure that our hospitals have the equipment and the staffing that they need to deal with this. The two main pieces of individual aid are the check that will go out to individuals and you know, $1,200 a person, $2,400, $2,500 a married couple, $500 for a dependent child under 16 and under. At this point, we're probably not seeking more for that, although depending upon the duration of this challenge, we may have to come back and do more. There was a problem right out of the gate that I mentioned that the administration was telling Social Security recipients that they couldn't get that money until they filed their tax return. We would have tried to fix that if the administration hadn't agreed to work with us and has fixed that already. So, but we definitely want more assistance to the healthcare network, including our frontline healthcare workers. And that is, you know, that's critical aid to individuals.
Hi, Senator Kane, Adiyande Till with WUSA 9 in D.C. I have two questions that came from our viewers. One is about if they're based off of taxes, getting their stimulus check based off taxes of last year, they were married last year. They went through a divorce last year, and all of the banking information goes back to how they filed before. How is that money going to be handled when it goes to the next phase of distributing it? That's number one. And then number two is people have been calling in who lived part of the year in Maryland or part of the year in D.C. and then the other part in Virginia. They've been directed to call Virginia specifically, but they call and can never get through to a person. I know you addressed bringing in more workers, but these people are dealing with this day in and day out and are afraid that, yes, they're going to get that money retroactively, but in the meantime, they can't afford to eat.
You know, look, both of those are very good questions, and I can't answer them right here. I would be very glad to follow up with any constituents that are having those issues. So, for example, how will we deal with folks whose marital status changed from the last time they filed a tax return? You know, the IRS has to deal with that issue all the time. With refunds and things like that. And so the IRS and the Treasury Department have a pretty good protocol for dealing with that, and I'm assuming that they would use the same protocol now. But I haven't had a constituent call me and ask that question where we've had to run that answer down. We'd be very glad to do it. On the Virginia, Maryland, D.C. people who are moving issue, I think that's an important one. I mean, I'll give you an example, just a personal one. I've got three children. Two of them are out of work because their jobs are shut down in that sense. So many families are dealing with that. I thought about my own kids, and I realized one of my kids moved between last year and this year. And so I reached out to her ASAP to make sure that she had, with the IRS, with everybody, that they had her current address so that a check wouldn't go to the wrong place. She is smarter than her dad and had already for years, her interaction with the IRS had been any refund went into a direct deposit. She moved her address, but she didn't change her bank account. And so, but I do think it's really important. If anybody's moved in the last year, it's really important to make sure that the IRS has your current information about where you are. If you can work, make your arrangement with the IRS to be a direct deposit arrangement, not only is that more secure, check not going to the wrong address, but it's also more likely to get you the money fastest. So from a consumer tip, I think those are two really good things for people to do. If you moved in last year, work with the IRS to make sure they have your proper information. And if you can work on a direct deposit basis, that would be very helpful.
Senator C.J. Pascoe.
This is Jenna Portnoy at the Post. How you doing?
Hi, Jenna.
My question is about D.C. in the fourth bill.
Yes.
As you know, they were treated as a territory in the first, and I'm curious if there's talk of direct funding to states in this fourth bill, and if so, if D.C. will be treated like a state and or made whole from the third bill.
Yes, D.C. needs to be treated like a state. The rationale for treating states and territories differently was that people who live in territories do not pay federal income tax, but people who live in D.C. do pay federal income tax. And so that was very unfortunate. That was a late breaker that Democrats worked very hard to try to get D.C. treated like a state, and we couldn't get there. But D.C. needs to be made whole from Bill 3. But going forward, if there is to be more aid to states, states and territories, D.C. needs to be treated like a state. So we need to do both, make them whole, but then treat them like a state going forward. I will say, Jenna, the other issue in this kind of aid to states and localities that has become a very significant issue is how states and localities can use the funds. This is one that we're working with Treasury to try to maybe they can help us on the implementation side, and we don't need to legislate, but we may have to legislate on it. The funds, the block grants to states and localities were not included in the original Republican proposal. Democrats worked very, very hard to get those dollars added to Virginia. That's $3.3 billion. It's going to be incredibly important as Virginia undergoes significant challenges. But the funds were limited to unanticipated expenses. They were not allowed to be used for unanticipated revenue losses. Compare it, for example, to the fifth pillar of the bill, aid to hospitals. Those dollars can be used to cover unanticipated revenue losses. States and localities should be able to use these block grant funds not just for unanticipated expenses, but also for unanticipated revenue losses. And that would include D.C., and we're going to work very hard in the next bill to fix that if we don't get some flexibility from Treasury in the implementing regulations.
Okay, thanks. Just to follow up on that, excuse me, do you have a timetable for the for this fourth bill?
No, I look, in a way, I view the sort of dueling UCs today as kind of the, you know, opening discussion about what should be in the fourth bill. Senator McConnell was not under the illusion that he could put a bill on the floor and the Democrats would just say an automatic yes to it. So he's doing this purely for a political reason. But nevertheless, his UC and the UC that Senator Schumer will offer sort of the start of the discussion. Right now we're scheduled to come back to D.C. on April 20. But we are on the phone with each other all the time. I've been trading emails back and forth this morning, for example, with my health committee colleagues about the fifth pillar of the bill, the aid to hospitals. And so what our hope would be is that we might be able to work, even though we're in our own, you know, communities, we might be able to work to put together the guts of a good, solid bill that we could then turn our attention to immediately when we come back on Monday, April 20.
Okay, thank you.
That.
Senator, this is Justin Madigan from the Times-Dispatch. I'm wondering, with the crisis at Canterbury here in Henrico County, how would you describe your level of concern about that situation, with it being on track to eclipse the nursing facility out in Washington, and are you satisfied with the state's response to the Canterbury situation?
It is obviously just completely tragic, and I will say that, you know, knowing many of these facilities across the state from service for now 25 years as a local official, state official, and official at the federal level, but also just as a person who has friends and family who have been in long-term care facilities, nursing homes, assisted living facilities in Virginia, the Canterbury facility is not one that you would have picked out and said, these guys are a bad apple. It's not. And to me, the fact that it could happen there suggests that all communities of this kind are vulnerable. An aging population, many of whom have significant health issues living in close proximity, that is an elevated risk factor. I also know something about staffing in these facilities. In many of these facilities, people work there and then they have other jobs as well because they're often not paid that well. And so if they're working in other locations and coming in, that can create some challenges. A lot of folks come into these facilities, obviously family members come and visit, of course they do. Facilities will have entertainment programming and bring in speakers or somebody to talk, or therapists who don't work full-time at any one facility move between facilities. I think what the Canterbury situation shows is that the nation really fell down when it came to testing, because had there been more rigorous testing earlier, we could have kept people away, particularly people who had COVID-19 but were asymptomatic. And so I I view the Canterbury circumstance, and we've talked with the governor about this, as a tragedy, but I don't think it's unique to this particular facility. I think the conditions are there in many such facilities that could lead to something like this, and we're going to have to step back at both the state regulatory but also at the federal level to assess. I know there's proposals for more funding for these facilities, but we're going to have to step back to assess from a regulatory standpoint, are there other things we should be doing to provide protection, not just for the residents, but also for the workers. I think about 25 workers have also been diagnosed as having coronavirus.
Thank you.
Senator Joe DeShiel, WGBJ.
Hey, Joe.
I just wanted to get back to the unemployment numbers and get your general reaction to the latest figures of 6.6 million filing last week and the total of 16.8 million over 3 weeks. What does that say about where we are in the crisis, the economic side of it, and where we're headed?
Well, it's completely unprecedented in my life. I'm 62 years old, and there's never been anything like this. The amount of economic dislocation and anxiety that people are feeling, you know, the health issue would be bad enough in terms of the anxiety and the effect on families, but then you add to it this economic dislocation issue. It is very, very troubling. And I'll tell you what makes it even more troubling is nobody knows. If we knew a date by which it would be over, it would still be painful, but at least we would be able to plan. We'd have some sense of it. Not knowing is also very, very hard for people as they're trying to plan what to do about their finances. I think we still have a ways to go in this economic crisis. We need to follow, but I say put the public health piece of it first. I continue to say that no matter what we do economically, it won't be enough if we don't do the public health piece right. And if we are finally starting to get the public health piece of it right, that's going to be the single best thing to get the economy back growing again. I hope there's recent news about the development of antibody testing that could determine whether folks have had coronavirus. So you want to have testing to determine if you have it. But it's also good to have tests to determine whether you have had it already, maybe without knowing it. And if so, do you then have some immunity that would enable you to go back to work, go back into kind of regular social interaction without worrying about your own health or about affecting others? That antibody testing is being ramped up dramatically. The bill that we put, COVID-3, has the ability to offer that testing for free as it gets ramped up. I think that will end up being a key component of getting folks back to work and to normal social interaction.
Senator C.J. Pascal, NBC 29 in Charlottesville. Our mayor, Nikiah Walker, here mentioned on a call with Mark Warner, she was asking him whether or not there had been any discussions about increased funding support for local governments. I know that Roanoke announced earlier this week that they were going to be furloughing some city governmental employees. I think it was actually the day after that call. Has that been any sort of discussion, and might that be potentially part of future aid packages to the states, including Virginia?
So first, what is in the bill right now for local government? So I think it's really important. The largest budget item for most local governments is their school system. The bill that we did produces for Virginia about $240 million to be distributed to the state's public school systems. And it also produces another $66 million that the governor has some flexibility to use either for K-12 or higher ed. So the State Department of Education has not yet run the number, at least as of the end of the day yesterday, about what each jurisdiction will get. But Roanoke, Charlottesville, Albemarle, every jurisdiction is going to get funds directly for use in their school system budget, which should help local governments. In addition, Virginia is going to get $3.3 billion in a block grant that is to be used not just for the state budget, but for states and localities. $200 million of that $3.3 is earmarked for Fairfax County, because any jurisdiction that has more than 500,000 got a specific earmark. But that doesn't mean that the other local governments aren't getting money. It just means that the other local governments will make the case to the governor about that $3.1 billion. A lot of that is for local governments. There's also dramatic increases in funding in things like the Community Development Block Grant Program, which is for local governments, the Child Care Development Block Grant Program, which is for local governments, and other grant programs that local governments can access. So there was a lot of funding. And frankly, the funding like the block grant, $3.3 billion in Virginia, that was not in the original proposal that was voted on the Sunday, two Sundays ago, but Democrats stayed at the table to make sure that it was, and that money can be very helpful to local governments trying to deal with this. There is a question about whether that aid is sufficient and whether we need to do additional monies. The proposal that Senator Schumer has on the table about what we need says very strongly we need additional money for state and local governments. But the important thing is local governments right now need to interact with the governor's office, because that $3.3 billion block grant, which is likely to start to get distributed next week, can be significantly used for local governments together with the educational funding that I mentioned.
Hi, this is Charlotte from Charlottesville Tomorrow, also in Charlottesville. Thank you, 29, for that question. It was a really great one. I guess I have one that's a little more specific to the newspaper sector. I saw yesterday that you and Warner contributed to a letter calling for funding for newspapers in future aid packages. Do you have any updates on that?
None yet about, you know, is that likely to be in package four or not. We put that out yesterday to start the discussion. Sources of good information that can inform people about what to do are critically important right now. We wouldn't be doing as good a job, finally, at the social distancing side were it not for journalists helping us spread that message. We wouldn't know about some critical issues like the outbreak of COVID-19 on the Teddy Roosevelt if it were not for journalists putting that out in a significant way. So the role of the press is always important, but in a time like this, it's particularly important, and we're troubled that, you know, advertising revenue, for example, for newspapers has just fallen off so dramatically with businesses being closed. That then leads newspapers to start laying folks off. But this is not a time when people need less information. It's a time when people need more information. So we put that out there as something we want to see. It is too early for me to tell you what's the likelihood of that being in a package and at what point in time.
Thank you.
And thanks so much, everyone. I think we'll actually have to wrap up right there, but we will follow up with audio after the call.
Thank you, everybody.
Have a good day, everyone.
Thank you.
Thank you.